I have the luxury of having it marked. So, yeah. So as we begin this new study, I have to make a confession. I don't really know exactly how I'm going to approach it overall. This is one of those unique books in Scripture that, as we'll see in just a few minutes, as we talk about some of the elements of this unique Old Testament book, this ancient book. And so I'm still kind of working through the overarching approach. Today, though, I wanted to spend a little bit of time providing some introductory material, and then we'll just kind of get into the first few verses of chapter 1 to begin to kind of set the stage for where this is going. How many of you would say you are moderately to very familiar with the Old Testament book of Job? Just raise your hand. Like, you've read it, you've lived in it, you've walked through trials in it, that kind of thing. Yeah. Most people who have been in the church and been walking with the Lord for some period of time at least have general familiarity with the book of Job. In fact, as we get into the study, we're going to find, you know, a lot of familiar verses or passages or phrases that sort of stick out even in our common vernacular. Have you heard of the patience of Job? Kind of a common, you know, euphemism or whatever. But these kinds of things, I know that my Redeemer lives. These kinds of statements flow out of Job. And so we're going to see some things in here that are really familiar to us, that ring familiar to us. And then in general, most of us understand that the book of Job is largely a book that centers on this matter of suffering and trial, as Nathan mentioned and prayed for. And so, you know, we have some familiarity from that standpoint. But I want to spend some time today sort of giving us a bit of a broad framework for the overall book and some things that will help us in our study going forward, some things that will sort of set up the right kind of frame of mind and the right sort of patterns of thinking as we kind of dig more deeply into the text. And the first thing I want to kind of mention to us and maybe even elaborate a little bit on is runs out of the title. I mean, it comes out of the title, The Grief and the Glory of God. But this idea of the themes that are universal and transcendent in Job, it's one of the things that makes this book so compelling, so relatable for so many people. It is one of those go-to kinds of books, particularly in times of trial. It's because the themes that are in it are universal. They're universally relatable. And then there's also a transcendence to the book of Job. When someone is experiencing grief, particularly grief of a pronounced and or prolonged nature, it is not uncommon for us as mortals to long for, appeal to, wonder about that which is transcendent, or even the one whom we either know to be transcendent, or if we're not a believer, we wonder and hope that there is a transcendent one who has transcendent purpose and can give transcendent meaning to the trials and travails that we experience in this fallen and corrupt world. These themes are universal and transcendent in this book. You have, of course, right out of the gate, as we've already alluded to, this universal experience of grief. And I would say the universal experience of grief in all of its forms, in all of its manifestations, and in all of its vexation. There's a great word. Write that down. It's a good word. Use that over coffee with someone. Grief, prolonged and protracted grief, that produces profound vexation, confusion, uncertainty, questions that just are plaguing us of why, when, how, these kinds of things. Job 5:7, in one of the speeches of one of Job's so-called friends, makes this statement in Job chapter 5, verses 6 and 7, "For affliction does not come from the dust, nor does trouble sprout from the ground. But listen to this. Man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upward." It's a great picture, a great metaphor of the universal nature, the universal experience of grief. As surely as sparks fly upward from a fire, man is born to trouble. It is not something that somehow springs up out of the ground so surprisingly, or is somehow planted in the ground and then, you know, is cultivated and then springs. It's like universal. We're born to it. It's as certain and as sure and as common, as the writer says, as sparks flying upward. We all experience profound seasons of grief in our lives. As Nathan prayed, some are experiencing profound grief even now. Some are experiencing even the depths of grief and the depths of vexation over grief. When will the pain subside? When will I be able to see my way clear? When will I be able to function normally again? It's universal. And it raises what is often referred to as the problem of evil, the problem of suffering. Now, why is evil or suffering a problem? If evil, or if the consequences of evil, or the consequences of living in a fallen and corrupt world, the griefs that we experience, the trials that we experience as a result of all that, if it is universal and it is common and we are born to it, then why would we also consider it, or why would some also consider it a problem? Well, it's a problem only if you believe that there is a transcendent and transcendently powerful and transcendently wise and good God. Otherwise, it's not a problem. In fact, every other sort of ideology or belief system throughout time immemorium hasn't had this kind of problem with suffering, with evil. When you look at the pantheon of the Greco-Roman gods, for example, they were characterized as capricious and arbitrary in their dealings with man. In fact, the suffering that men would experience was oftentimes attributed to some drama that was going on amongst the gods. There could be some battle or some jealousy or some rivalry or something like that that's going on amongst these Roman or Greek gods, and it's resulting in some form of human trouble. Maybe there is a god who is concerned about the elevation of power and prestige of a particular ruler or king, and they need to be knocked down a few notches, and so that's why someone is suffering. That's why the king and all of his subjects are suffering, because the god so-and-so became jealous of his rising power and could not abide by a human, a mere mortal, thinking that they are ascending to the level or the echelon of the gods. So it was easy. It's easy amongst those who have a belief in something other than a singular, transcendent, all-powerful, all-knowing, all-wise, and all-good God. It's easy for those that don't believe that, in some ways, to not really see evil or suffering or grief as this kind of problem. However, if we believe in this kind of God that I've described, for many, it is the most fundamental problem. It is the most challenging question to ponder. It is the most difficult question at times to land on a suitable answer. And we're going to see elements of this all throughout this study. One commentator described this issue like this. He says, strictly speaking, human misery, or the larger sum of evil in all its forms, is a problem only for the person who believes in one God who is all-powerful and all-loving. Outside such faith, there are many explanations of evil which involve a denial or a limitation of either God's sovereignty or of his goodness. That's what I was describing in the pantheon of gods. The argument has been expressed with philosophical clarity as follows. If God were perfectly good, he could not tolerate the existence of violence, disease, etc. Therefore, There must be some limit to his ability to control such events. That is, he is not almighty. Alternatively, if God does have complete power over everything that happens, his failure to curb the wrongs that occur must be due to the fact that he does not see anything wrong in them. That is, he is not good. We and Job put forward a God who is neither limited in his power nor bereft in his goodness and his loving kindness. In fact, he is quite the opposite. He is the God who is supreme in power, and that will be revealed on the pages of Job without question. And he is also the God of complete beneficence, complete goodness. And so this book will help us contend with these deep and profound questions about the problem of evil. Theodicy is the theological term. It's the defense of God's goodness and omnipotence in view of the existence of evil. So we'll be able to dive into apologetic and theological issues that Job will help us to effectively address. But it stems from, as I said, this universal theme of grief that we all know and that we all experience to varying degrees. And then you have this theme of transcendence, the revealed transcendent glory of God, that is in fact the beginning, middle, and end and purpose of all things. Like, we will see in this study that God is before, in between, around, in control of, over, underneath, and purposing all things, even these profound experiences of grief and trouble. You get to the end of this incredible book, and you find, after Job has been, in a sense, confronted by the Almighty himself, he has this statement that is just, to me, emblematic of what we're talking about here in this revelation of transcendence. After being sort of confronted of experiencing this magnificent, transcendent, all-powerful God, Job says at the end, "I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you." This experience, this knowing of the transcendent God becomes paramount in our understanding of the purpose of grief and the glory of God in and through it. So this is what I think is a key element for this book and for our study that will be, I hope, resonant for us. It will sort of connect with us in profound ways as we go through it. The second thing I want to kind of draw out a little bit here is that it has a literary style and a genre that is really unparalleled. It's a very unique book. It's unique for many reasons, as we'll see as we study this. From a literary perspective, it stands alone in all of Scripture. In other words, you can't too narrowly place Job into a particular and well-defined literary genre or category. Francis Anderson, in his commentary, says this: "The book of Job is an astonishing mixture of almost every kind of literature to be found in the Old Testament. Many individual pieces can be isolated and identified as proverbs, riddles, hymns, laments, curses, lyrical nature poems." It's very varied, to be a little bit redundant. It has a very unique literary style. Some even compare Job to epic literature, or a kind of epic literature. It's sort of epic-like. It has grand themes, as we've already alluded to, of human suffering and divine justice. It has a larger-than-life protagonist, Job, this man who endures what is ultimately understood as a cosmic trial, a cosmically sourced degree and extent and type of suffering. And it also engages the reader in these universal questions, these universal themes, these universal questions, which is similar to traditional epic literature. There are some distinct differences from epic literature, but it has that kind of those kinds of components associated with it. And again, this matter of it raising universal questions, boy, does it ever raise questions. In fact, you will find in the book of Job well over 100 questions, particularly in the ESV translation, that are referenced in this book. Well over 200. Did I say 100? Well over 200 questions. Some estimates are as high as 250, and it kind of depends upon, you know, translation. The Hebrew didn't have, you know, like a question mark at the end of the sentence to know it was specifically to be framed up in English as a question. But nevertheless, hundreds of questions emerge literally from the text of Job. Questions of varying types and also of varying intents, varying purposes. You have questions that are lamenting kinds of questions. They are expressions of anguish, conveying despair and frustration or emotional pain, understandably. Often you hear this in Job's dialogues and lamenting his particular crucible of trial and suffering. Some examples, Job 3:11. Job, at an extreme point of despair, says, "Why did I not die at birth? Come out from the womb and expire. Why was I even born?" You'll find this lament expressed in a couple of different ways. And then Job 7:20, you have one of his friends asking him the question, "If I sin," no, excuse me, this is Job asking God, "If I sin, what do I do to you, you watcher of mankind? Why have you made me your mark?" It's more of a lamenting question, an expression of anguish. It's emotional. It's asking why and how, and it's really focused on the pain. Then you have challenging or accusatory questions that run throughout the book. Questions that are intended to confront or accuse or demand accountability. Oftentimes these questions are directed right at God, but they're also directed at Job, his friends, sort of aiming to challenge his position about his own blamelessness in the face of all this suffering. Some examples in Job 1:9. This is God himself, we'll find, basically asking a question, challenging the accuser, challenging Satan, who had come before him with the sons of God. God says this, "Does Job fear God for no reason?" And God's not asking that question because he doesn't know the answer. He's asking that question in a bit of a challenging or accusatory tone. In Job 13:24, Job says, "Why do you hide your face and count me as your enemy?" It's a little bit different than just lament and anguish. This is Job calling out to God in a bit of a challenging or accusatory tone. It's confrontational, seeking to provoke or defend. You have a lot of questions that are just rhetorical in nature. They're just sort of trying to teach a point designed to sort of assert the truth that's in view or to teach a lesson or to emphasize a point. Some examples of the rhetorical type questions are Job 38:4, "Where were you, Job?" This is the Lord talking to Job. "Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding." God's not asking this question of Job because he's expecting Job to provide some really salient data about where he was when God laid the foundation of the earth. He's saying that to make a very important point to Job. And the point is, you were not when I laid the foundation of the earth. Not only were you just not there, you were not. That's a rhetorical type of question. Job 4:7, "Remember, who that was innocent ever perished? Or where were the upright cut off?" This is one of Job's friends sort of accusing Job for his incessant insistence on his blamelessness before God, that his grief is not a result of sin, that he stands blameless before God, and one of his friends is just really not buying it. How could this possibly be? And he's asking these questions to sort of accuse Job of his insolence. And then Job 34:17, shall one who hates justice govern? Will you condemn him who is righteous and mighty? This is Elihu, Job's friend, sort of defending God against Job and Job's claims of his own justification before God. So these questions are more intended to make a point, a rhetorical point, not to seek an answer. There are questions, however, that are seeking understanding, or it's a pursuit of genuine understanding to gain insight or clarity. Job 7:17, what is man that you make so much of him and that you set your heart on him? Job's wondering why God even pays attention to humanity, trying to understand God's divine purposes in it all. Job 10:2, I will say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know why you contend against me. Job's seeking clarity on why he's suffering and the reasons for it. And then Job 21:7, why do the wicked live, reach old age, and grow mighty in power? This is obviously Job questioning why there are blessings bestowed on those who are actually wicked and are set against God himself. So these are questions that are actually intended to pursue clarity, pursue greater understanding. And then finally, there are questions that are more of a testing or probing kind of nature. They're seeking to sort of test the motives or the faith or the understanding of someone. Job 2:9, we'll get to this, but unfortunately, Job's wife doesn't get a good rap in this book. At the end of the second section of the Council of the Sons of God, before God and before his throne, and additional suffering is laid upon Job. This is what his wife says. Then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die. She's not asking that question because she wants to know an answer. She's testing Job. Have you lost your mind? After all this, is it really possible that there is a God in heaven who cares for you? And then Job 42, shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? He who argues with God, let him answer it. Again, testing and probing. These are provocative questions. They're similar to some of the other types of questions, but a little bit of a shade of difference there. The point is that all throughout the book, we're going to come across question after question after question after question. And some of the questions are intended in these various ways that I mentioned, and some we will actually take up as though we're needing to ask ourselves these questions and then seek to answer them according to truth. It's a book that's full of questions in this unique and very distinct style in which it is written. You'll also find, as we study through this, that it has a very poetic and symmetrical structure. Much of the book is in the form of verse or Hebraic poetry, especially the dialogues, and the dialogues make up a large portion of the book of Job. Just to give you a little bit of a structure of it, I mean, this is just, kind of maybe more seminary class kinds of notes, but if you think about the top-level breakdown of the overall book, you basically have the introduction in the first five verses, and then you have what you might call the speeches, which make up the bulk of the book, and that starts in verse 6, beginning with sort of the dialogue between Satan and God and that gathering of the sons of God that we'll look at, all the way through chapter 42, verse 6. And then you have this conclusion that begins in chapter 42, verse 7 through verse 17. If you break it down a little further, you'll see the symmetry continues because you have within the speeches section, this large section, you have two interviews with God, you have a dialogue of Job with his friends, and then you conclude with two interviews of God with Job. So there's a little bit of symmetry even in that structure within these speeches, and that's the breakdown of the verses. And then you break it down even further and you see even more symmetry. In the actual dialogue section, you also see four rounds of speeches with Job, and then at the conclusion of this dialogue section, you see four speeches by Elihu, the final friend that shows up on the scene. This is just pointed to give you a sense that the book is written not just in some type of historical narrative form. When we come to the book of Job, it's not like we're going to come to this history book that's just going to sort of give us, you know, this narrative of people and events and things that take place. Especially since the bulk of the book is in the form of this sort of symmetrical Hebrew poetry, you're not going to find one person speaking and then Job responding and having Job sort of have the dialogue match up as though they're just having this conversation where a question's being asked and then an answer's being given and they just kind of interact around a particular idea. It's much more poetic than that, and it's really intended to convey a rhythm of themes or thematic ideas in the form of Hebrew poetry. Another thing that's kind of unique about this book is that it has a date and a setting that is definitely ancient. It's an ancient book. It's an ancient setting. The author and date of Job is unknown. It's not. No one can be specific or dogmatic about either. There's a lot of evidence that suggests that Job lived during the time of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, contemporaries of that period of Old Testament history. There's even evidence that could point to the writing of Job that would predate Moses' writings of the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Old Testament. Some scholars would argue that Job is, in fact, the oldest book in Scripture in terms of its writing. It certainly doesn't capture the oldest human history. That's Genesis, in the beginning, God, right? But in terms of when it was written, there are some who would point to Job as being the most ancient of all Scripture. And it would also point to Job as being part of that ancient class in the patriarchal period. There are some credible scholars that would argue for a later date of writing. They would put it after the time of Moses. Some would put it during the time of Solomon. And those assertions are not without merit, but you can't be dogmatic on either front. I think that one thing I found compelling, or a couple of things that I found compelling about the ancient nature of this book, is that you will not find many Hebrew references in Job, or excuse me, you will find, I should say, in the Hebrew text of Job, many ancient references that have no comparison in more contemporary or I guess later Hebrew scriptural writings. It even presents quite a few conundrums for translators because they'll come to a word in the Hebrew text of Job and no one knows what it is. And there's no comparative reference point to go to. It's sort of in the text itself. Some of the terminology is anachronistic. It sort of seems out of time and place in some way. None of those translation difficulties afford any problems to understanding the meaning of a particular passage or text. It just creates problems where, you know, there has to be some speculation around that's what this word might mean in this context. So there's a sort of an ancient nature of the actual text itself in many, many examples. But then also, it's noteworthy that in the book of Job, there are no references to any major events or major characters in Israel's grand history. There's none of that. It sort of stands alone and stands apart from all of that. It does obviously retain what you might refer to as a clearly patriarchal theological perspective or viewpoint, but it does not encapsulate or give any reference to anything related to Israel's history, Israel's Mosaic code, Israel's practice of temple worship, none of that. You don't find any of that in Job. And so it could be indication that it's because it predates all of that. Again, can't be dogmatic, but certainly it is an ancient text. It is an old text, and it is understood as such. Another thing that I think is really compelling about this study, and I think we'll find compelling, is that it has a theological breadth and depth that is vast. I've already kind of alluded to this in one way or another, but it's hard to overstate this. The paths that we will be able to traverse in terms of theological depth and just broadening our thinking and our understanding about the nature and character of God, his purposes for man, it really is a deep, deep well. We'll never reach the bottom, in other words. And I'm not trying to say that we're going to be in this study for 17 years, but it's broad and deep. Listen to Francis Anderson in the Tyndale Old Testament Commentary, the way he sort of describes this. I think he really is articulate in how he captures this theological breadth and depth that we're going to be partaking in this study. He says, "The Old Testament book about Job is one of the supreme offerings of the human mind to the living God and one of the best gifts of God to men. The task of understanding it is as rewarding as it is strenuous. For his help, the modern student has a rich legacy from the labors of the past. It is a tribute to the greatness of the book that the work of interpreting it is never finished. After each fresh exploration, the challenge to scale the heights remains. One is constantly amazed at its audacious theology and at the magnitude of its intellectual achievement. Job is a prodigious book in the vast range of its ideas, in its broad coverage of human experience, in the intensity of its passions, in the immensity of its concept of God, and not least in its superb literary craftsmanship. It reaches widely over the complexities of existence, seeking a place for animals as well as men in God's world. It plumbs the depths of human despair, the anger of moral outrage, and the anguish of desertion by God. From one man's agony, it reaches out to the mystery of God beyond all words and explanations. It is only God himself who brings Job joy in the end. And when all is done, the mystery remains. God stands revealed in his hiddenness, an object of terror, adoration, and love. And Job stands before him like a man, trusting and satisfied." This is going to be a tremendous study as we sort of dive off into the deep end of it. And I'm really looking forward to taking this on with all of you. Now, a little bit of stepping into the text itself. I want to start by beginning to set the stage here, because that's what happens here in the opening verses. And what we find here is our introduction to the man, Job. And what we see right out of the gate is, first of all, we see Job the blameless. In verse 1, it says, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil." This is the characterization of this man, Job, and we can maybe quickly pass over that and say, wow, this guy must have been a great guy. But we can't pass over it too quickly, because that truth, that reality, that characterization, the blamelessness of Job, not the perfection of Job, not a man who's without any faults or failures, but blameless before God. This characterization of Job is the backdrop for everything that follows, including all of the dialogues between Job and his friends. We must always keep in our view that Job is set up for us to be known as blameless. He is a man who stands before God upright, one who genuinely and sincerely understands and walks in the fear of the Lord. He was indeed, by every account and definition, a man of God. And the characteristic of that fear of the Lord was that he turned away from evil, that he walked in uprightness, and he understood that evil was always afoot, and it was that which he constantly needed to turn away from if he was to continue to live out and walk in this blamelessness in the fear of the Lord. He was blameless. It's interesting, we're not going to go too far into this, but you get down into even the account of the Lord God himself as he is having this dialogue with Satan. You'll see that the Lord gives this same type of commendation to Job In chapter 8, he says, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil?" So this is not just the testimony of the writer of Job, it is the testimony of God himself about this man Job. He was blameless. He was upright. And this has tremendous bearing on how we understand the rest of this account. Secondly, he was Job the blessed. Job the blessed. He was an extremely blessed man in many, many respects. Starting in verse 2, it says, "There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 female donkeys, and very many servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the people in the East." This is a testimony to the vastness of Job's wealth and resources and influence in an entire region. His estimated wealth is multiple millions in contemporary dollars. And it's really hard to estimate, because it's hard to encapsulate what all would it be included in his estate, if you will, in terms of just land resources. Because when you think of all of this livestock and all of the grazing and herding of all this livestock that he owned, that's described here in detail, not only did he have all of this livestock, but he also had vast amounts of land on which that livestock grazed and on which he raised that livestock and traded that livestock. And then you have this reference to the many servants that worked for him. What the writer is painting a picture of here is Job as a man who had vast resources, but also far-reaching influence. And the point of all that is that what we need to see is that what happens to Job happens to many people. The ripple effect of Job's trial has a spillover effect that spreads far and wide. It's hard to even calculate. That's the picture that's being painted for us. This is a man who not only is upright, but he is blessed with tremendous resources and far-reaching influence and impact with many, many people who are engaged with him and even reliant upon him in many, many substantive ways. So much so that he is described here as the greatest of all the people in the East. This is an incredible commendation. So he's blessed with immense sort of financial resources, if you will, monetary resources, as well as human capital, if you want to call it that. But then it goes on to say his sons used to go and hold a feast. So you have, first of all, you have the family blessing of 7 sons and 3 daughters. So a large family that is mentioned there at the beginning. But then it goes on to sort of characterize the blessedness of this family dynamic, starting in verse 4. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. This little sentence here is just to give us a picture of the fact that this was not just a family that was large, and which in and of itself is a blessing, but it is the character or the qualitative nature of the family relationships that are being described here to give a sense that Job, as the patriarch of this family, was able to sort of revel in the goodness of God as it was being manifest in these loving and friendly and celebratory relationships amongst his own children. And we all, many of us can understand how unique and blessed this kind of condition would be. Many of us might know how blessed this has to be because many of us experience or have experienced something very different in our families, right? Maybe you have brothers and sisters that you're estranged from. Maybe they're unbelieving. Maybe you've got family dynamics that you have to kind of deal with every sort of big holiday or family gathering, and it's not described like this. It doesn't carry this kind of familial blessedness But not so with Job. On their day, probably like a birthday celebration, they would come together and they would feast and they would celebrate one another and enjoy the revelry of revelry and blessing of close-knit family bonds and family relationships. So Job was indeed a man who was richly, richly blessed. He was blameless. He was blessed. But he was also beneficent. And this is me having to get another B word. I'm not trying to be too impressive here. Okay? I struggled with this one. I had to look it up. I had to figure it out. Job the beneficent. Job the good. There was blameless, standing upright before God in the fear of God, but acting in goodness. And you see a picture of this as you move forward in verse 5. And when the days of the feast had run their course, this feasting of these birthday celebrations had run their course, Job would send and consecrate them, his children. And he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. So here you have a man, blessed beyond measure, materially, blessed beyond measure, familially, and yet his heart and mind turns to the standing of his children before a holy God as paramount, as supreme. And he intercedes as sort of the priest of the family. This might be another indication of the ancient nature of the writing of Job. It's another sort of possible reason for it. There's no sort of priestly office that's been established. He's the priest of his family in the ultimate formal sense of it, offering these sacrifices. And he did this continually on behalf of his children. Job was a good man. Job was a good man who did good things. He operated in goodness. He acted out of goodness, out of beneficence, out of kindness and care and concern for others. We'll see as we get into the rest of the book, there's more testimony of Job and his goodness in his community, in caring for those who are needy around him. There are acts of benevolence that are recounted later on in the book that indicate Job was not just good in this way on behalf of his own children, but he had this heart of goodness that compelled him toward tangible acts of goodness that had benefit and blessing upon those around him in his community. He was a man of tremendous prominence and tremendous influence, of blamelessness and goodness and blessing that is hard to even compare to any other person that we would know. And so, when you get to the next stage, when you get to the next scene, when the setting changes from this description of Job and his life and his surroundings and his possessions and his family and sort of the characterization of life in his family and in his community and the things that he did, the setting will suddenly turn, and we'll get there next week, into sort of the courtroom or the council room of God himself. And we'll see that everything that is pointed to here that holds Job up as a man who is richly blessed begins to come completely unraveled. And we have to ask ourselves these questions. Why? What's the purpose? What is God doing in all of this? How can God be just? How can we maintain our righteousness, our goodness, our blessedness in the face of this kind of grief?